Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. If you cannot listen to this entire show today, this show will be rebroadcasted on Saturday at 10:30, just before the Whitworth game. As an educational show, as you know, many parts of these shows kind of cross-reference each other, so that you need to stay abreast so that you can garner what Republic Review is and understand some of these principles and some of these facts and how they cross-reference with each other. So to do that, you really need to download the podcasts, which are available at ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, so that you can stay informed. Local announcements. This Friday is the Dave Moore, November 10th, and this is the Republican Coffee Club coffee meeting at 7 o'clock, and this is over on Trent and Hamilton. And Dave Moore will be talking about the Wunderwaffe of World War II, the super weapons, basically. And on the 17th will be election coverage, right Spokane perspective, hosting Mike and Tim. And so that's Mike Fagan and Tim Benn. Anyway, the 24th will be Thanksgiving and or the Friday after Black Friday, so they will not be having coffee and donuts that day. Probably will be stuffed enough from the turkey and the libations, I'm sure. Anyway, last week we had Bob Zadek on, and he will be our guest again for this week and even for next week. And I want to let you know a little bit more about Bob, because they didn't have a chance because we were talking more about the election. And because today is the day after election, I'm really not going to get into some analysis at this point. I think I'd rather tell you more about Bob. And we'll get into the analysis next week of winners, losers, and my take on this. But Bob has been a practicing finance lawyer for 50 years and is listed in the best lawyers in America and has been awarded the highest rating for ethical standards and legal ability by peer-reviewed Martindale Hubbell. Bob holds a law degree and a master's degree in law from New York University School of Law and is a charter fellow in the American College of Commercial Finance Lawyers. He's the past president of the Association of Commercial Finance Attorneys, past chair of the 1,500-member Commercial Finance Committee of the Business Law Section of the American Bar Association, and past chair of the California State Bar UCC Committee. Bob is the host of The Bob Zadek Show. It's the longest-running libertarian show, I think, in California. His stations and broadcasting times are listed on my podcast page and will be moved to my link page when my interviews and discussions with Bob have completed. But Bob's passions, if you haven't been able to tell from last week, his passion is American history, entrepreneurism, libertarianism, and his number one fan and significant other is Anne. So we're going to have Bob back on after the break. So as soon as we come back from the break, I will be engaging in my conversation with Bob some more. I know we just finished the election, and like I said, I'm going to deal with that next week. What I think is important is to reinforce the elitist concept of communism with some of the things that has happened in the news. First and foremost is the Hillary and DNC collusion and perversion. I thought the Democrats were supporters of democracy. Is this why everyone has wasted their time in voting in the 2016 election? Because the fix was in? What a bunch of hypocrites. Talk about disenfranchised voters. It's not about voter ID. It's about a rigged system. And if anybody wants to be upset, it should be the Democrats. They should leave that party because they are a party of elitists and they know better than even the voters. And this whole ruse over voter ID is just that, a ruse making you think that, you know, they're trying to disenfranchise voters when the Democratic Party just did that in 2016. They completely disenfranchise their voters by setting up everybody else to lose and Hillary to win. The black Democrat is, I think, the most disaffected, and they complain again about the voter ID laws, but this is elitism at its best. And as a matter of fact, when you find hardcore communist nations, then you will find precisely how elitist the Democrats align, just like these communist nations. There's also this case of Justin Fairfax, the candidate running for lieutenant governor in Virginia, who was left off the Democratic palm card handout literature. Why did this happen? And do you know who he is? Well, he happens to be the black candidate for the Democrats on the ticket. And they're starting to take local heat. But why aren't you hearing about this in the local press? Why is the Democratic Party not taking a big hit in the face on this and being shamed for this by the mainstream media? It's because the mainstream media's fix is in as well. They do everything they can to do damage control for the progressives because they are promoting this elitist mentality in making sure that you are going to be tended to by your government. And I am telling you that when you're voting for the progressives, when you're voting for candidates for the Democratic Party, that is what you're going to get. This is not a minor race, like a school board race or a candidate race out there in Virginia. He's a lieutenant governor candidate. And I'm just overwhelmed with how bad the mainstream media is not handling this or not exposing this. And I guess they're just getting tired of all the flack that they're getting over these Democratic Party and DNC fiascos that are coming out. So, bottom line, if you want evidence of filtering, you don't really have to look too far because the mainstream media is doing everything they possibly can to do damage control and spinning this. Folks, this is elitism. This is what you can expect if the progressive communists continue to own the Democratic Party. The only way you're going to change the Democratic Party is for everybody to leave it, abandon it, and force it to getting back to American principles and constitutional principles and not about the nanny state. America and its cities, suburbs, and rural areas will continue to get worse if we keep electing Democrats because of the elitist progressive communist ideology. Again, Plato designed the foundation for the statist society of communism. And I've been talking about this, I don't know how many times, but I have to go back to this again. In his design, there were three classes of people: leaders, workers, and teachers. The teachers were the ones to train and condition a sinless society because sin would be redefined. There would no longer be this hate or greed or jealousy, envy, lust, or malice, or any of those types of sins, because they're going to redefine it and they're going to get rid of the consequences of it. You know, if you get pregnant, well, then you just have an abortion. If you have health problems, well, then they'll just take care of you. The workers on this side, or in out of these three, would not be envious because the leaders and the elitists in the society or in these classes, because they're going to be taught to see things this way. The leaders would not oppress the workers, or at least on paper, that is how it is asserted. But we all know the adage about how power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The teachers would condition each class to willingly accept their assigned role in this perfect society, and they're staying within these boundaries. But again, those elitists at the top can't help but get carried away with themselves, and they always like to practice despotism. So here's the interesting point. And this is pointed out in the Communist Manifesto. The breeders would be chosen based on superior intelligence, performance, physical attributes, longevity, genes, and so forth. And children would be taken from their mothers, just like in Russia. So this Plato doctrine that was part of the Republic back in Plato's time has actually been manifested. It's been manifested in Russia. We're starting to see these things coming here, where we're starting to see the masses and these kids. And that's why the majority of the millennials are okay with communism. And it's because they've been inculcated or brainwashed by our education system to accept this, because they will be better off being taken care of by the government than having to fend for themselves. They have been bred into indolence. And I want you to start, you know, understanding this. And that's why elections do matter. As you can hear, we're up on a hard break, and we're going to go into our commercial break real quick, and we'll be back with Bob Zadik. So please stay tuned, and please support our sponsors. Thank you so much. Okay, so folks, we are back. I still have Bob with us. We're holding him over. So again, this is a pre-recorded segment. But Bob, before we went to break, I said two things. There was still a question. I believe that there are parchment barriers that weren't adequate that the framers, Hamilton and Madison, both pointed out. And it really did come up in the ratification debates, but it wasn't a finger in the eye type of thing. But they kind of understood that the states were going to be responsible for holding the federal government in check. And so the question was that one thing that they should have done? You know, was it, creating a review or you know, an oversight panel, or I won't feed the words in your mouth. I believe the states still failed in holding the federal government in check for the separation of powers vertically, and I kind of commented on that. And then once we, you know, kind of work through this in its volition, I'd love to get your feedback on Republic Review. So what's that one thing?
Well, there's probably two things. The history of the devolution of power from the states to the federal government, and I should say the unfortunate, regretful, in my opinion, because I'm a very strong federalist. I favor local control, not the feds, but the states, not the states, but the counties, not the counties, but the cities, not the cities, but the blocks, as local as possible. That's my worldview, because that's when democracy works the best, when people are voting on local issues. But that's my opinion, and that's not your question. Okay, when did it all happen? The first event that changed the balance of power that the founders delivered to us between Washington and the states was the Civil War Amendments, the 14th Amendment specifically. That was the amendment that said the Bill of Rights and all of the other protected rights, and remember, the Bill of Rights only lists some of the rights that the federal government cannot interfere with.
Correct.
Remember the often forgotten Ninth Amendment, the most important amendment of all, that says, I'm paraphrasing, the fact that certain rights are listed in the Bill of Rights is not to deny that there are many other rights that citizens have that the federal government cannot interfere with. So the Ninth Amendment, which was very important at the time, made sure that everybody understood that this was not a complete list of natural rights, but only a partial list.
Okay. Right.
But those rights, the enumerated and the unenumerated rights, were protected. The federal government couldn't mess with them, but the states always could, and the federal government couldn't stop it, at least not under the Constitution. That all changed after the Civil War, when the states had all of these rights that were interfering with the rights of what was then called Negroes, the blacks. And they were powers the state was doing. And the 14th Amendment said, okay, states, you can't do that anymore. That the blacks, then called Negroes, now blacks, the blacks have certain rights of citizens, and states cannot take away those rights. That's what was done to attack the Jim Crow laws in the states. It was the 14th Amendment. So for the first time, the Constitution is applied directly to regulate state behavior. The second event, less understood, was
the darkest year of the Constitution, 1913, the year of the 16th Amendment.
Right, the progressive era is what we call that, the progressive era. Yes.
Teddy Roosevelt was president, and that's when it all changed, the income tax. Now, the income tax changed everything, even though it didn't appear to have anything to do with state-federal power. But for the first time, the federal government is given the power to pull tax dollars out of the citizens of the states and put it in Washington. Once that happens, all power shifted, because now the federal government can suck the money out of the states with the income tax and then give it right back to the states, but with conditions, block grant and the like, which means if the states want what is, in my opinion, their own money back from Washington, they get it back, but with conditions imposed by Washington. Thus, Washington takes over the police power that was jealously given to the states and the states alone. That's when it all changed. The 16th Amendment gave us the mess we have today, with no more, with states having profoundly diminished powers.
So let me inject real quick, because this is important, because I've had these conversations with a lot of other constitutional scholars, with Dr. Vile, who's talked about that. Actually, he points to three times the Constitution slid, and the Civil War and the Reconstruction era, the Progressive era, and he also talks about the Great Society era and the New Deal type of era, when they, you know, even took on more of the progressive agendas from FDR into Johnson's time frame. But let me put this into a perspective for everybody, because I did this with Dr. Vile. Each of these processes, except for the Civil War era, the Civil War era actually did apply the Bill of Rights constraints upon the states. So the states could no longer take away and to be very clear here, not all of the Bill of Rights, only those that basically applied to the individual privileges and immunities. So it was for the individual, because at the time there were still states that had state-sponsored churches, and they didn't go after the states for saying, hey, the Establishment Clause now applies to the states. And if you read Bingham's arguments in the Congressional Globe on this, he basically says, no, we're just applying the Bill of Rights to the individuals. Now, there's a lot of people that fight this, but I agree with you that the 14th Amendment, Section 1, clearly does apply these privileges and immunities towards the individuals against the states. And that's where, when states go, you know, taking guns or creating these regulations, infringing on the rights and so forth, absolutely they're stepping on the 14th Amendment, not the 2nd Amendment. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so
exactly right.
I just wanted to, you know, frame this, that these were the privileges and immunities that applied to the people and didn't really have any types of effects and or impacts as far as the powers that the states still could, you know, or the states could still have established religions, because I don't think the last established religion of the original 13, I believe it was New Hampshire, it was 1877 when they basically went to secularism. And I think South Carolina was around 1867 or 1870, something like that. It was still after the Civil War era and the 14th Amendment. So there were still two states out of the original 13. And so there's, you know, this argument, because the states did not get harassed by the federal government regarding the Establishment Clause or anything like that. It was really for the freemen. That's the term I like to use, is the freemen, because here's a group of free people now that we've emancipated, and they have a right for all the privileges and immunities that the Constitution and or the Bill of Rights was guaranteeing. And so, anyway, so I still think that there's still something that the states should have done to keep from the encroachment, because bottom line, even though the civil right created this little shift, and even though more importantly, the 1913 under Wilson's, the 16th and 17th Amendment may have created a little shift, It didn't give the federal government carte blanche privileges of spending money. It gave them carte blanche privileges of taxing people. But they still had to, they still were constrained on what they could spend their money on. And that was the enumerated powers. And I point this out to Dr. Vial, and he goes, yeah, you're absolutely correct. And other scholars, they'll all agree with that. And so I apologize not giving you a chance to come back on this. So stay tuned. And
Bob's just stayed right there. We'll be right back after we have a few words from our sponsors. Thank you so much. And please stay tuned, folks.
Okay, so I am back, and I want to see Bob with the setup, because I understand that there were these skews, or there these I'll call them little tremors, but what these tremors didn't do was they didn't open up portals for the federal government to create new powers for themselves. There was nowhere in the 16th and 17th Amendment that says, now you can create a Department of Education, now you can do all of these other things. That was not anywhere given to them. Do you not agree with that?
I don't agree because we haven't told, I don't agree in part, because we haven't told our listeners and friends out there the second half of the story of 1913.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
The darkest year of the Constitution. What else happened in 1913?
We stood up the Fed.
We have discussed the 60th Amendment, the income tax.
Uh-huh.
We then have to now answer your question as to why the states were as passive as they have been while their power gets eroded. The reason is the 17th Amendment. Now, if we had a live audience sitting out there in some coliseum and I asked for volunteers, I would say, without Googling, who can tell me what the 17th Amendment did? There would be no hands. The 17th Amendment changed the country for the worse and forever. The 17th Amendment, done, as you have said, during the populist era of Teddy Roosevelt, the 17th Amendment changed the basic fabric of the Constitution and the separation of powers by changing how senators are elected. From the founding until 1913, senators were elected not by the people, but by the state houses. So the states themselves elected their senators. What's the significance of that? Why do I assign so much importance to something that nobody knows anything about? Well, the reason is simple. The states, from the founding until 1913, had a seat at the table. They had their guys, because they were then all men, they had their guys in Washington making sure the federal government didn't reduce state powers and state prerogatives. Once the 17th Amendment is passed, and senators are responsible to the popular will, to the people, to the tyranny of the majority of the people, rather than to the states directly, now the senators become far more passive about allowing the federal government to usurp power from the states to Washington, because so long as their voters were happy, they got reelected. Before 1913, states did not lose and could not have lost very much power because they had their guys in Washington watching out for it. So the answer to your question is, why were the states so passive? Because of the horrible effect of the 17th Amendment. And I would just point out, before we leave the topic of the 17th Amendment, the founders were brilliant political theorists. They knew politics and the dynamics of voting cold. When they created the Senate as being the body of Congress which were representing the states, They knew what they were doing. When that wisdom was changed by the 17th Amendment, it was changed during a period of populist fervor and quite impulsively, and there was zero thought given to the 17th Amendment, which negated all of the intense wisdom that went into creating the Senate. So a bunch of emotional, impulsive people undid the wisdom of the founders, and that we will forever regret.
Well, so if you look at the 17th Amendment, it only changed how the selection process was, and I truly believe that he who pays the piper calls the tune. But still, there was nothing within the 17th Amendment that said, now, you know, you don't need to go through the Article 5 process anymore to create any new constitutional powers. You can do whatever you want to. The 17th Amendment didn't do that. The 17th Amendment only changed the Article 1, Section 2 process of the selection of senators. And by the way, it didn't change the Article 5 process that basically is called the Amendment Protection Clause. It's the very last part of Article 5 that says, hey, you can't touch the closing down of the slave trade. So you can't pass an amendment that's going to do that. And you can't pass an amendment that's going to take away the suffrage of the states in the Senate without their consent. So the states that rejected this technically could say, we're not held by this because that amendment didn't affect the Article 5. It only affected the Article 2 process. But that's a different aside, and that would be definitely a great discussion to go down. But the point I'm bringing all of this in is that the 17th Amendment just changed the process. They still, if they wanted to create a department, for, if they wanted to take upon the role of Social Security, they still have to go through the amendment process, because the 17th Amendment didn't give a magical bullet of bypassing or creating a process that they could just usurp powers upon themselves. Again, the Constitution was still a limited and defined Constitution. They only made some process changes. Is that not correct?
You're exactly correct. And everything you said about the amendment process is absolutely correct. The missing piece in the conversation, the 800-pound gorilla, so to speak, is the role of the Supreme Court. And it is a fascinating study to learn how and when the Supreme Court made its decisions because that's what the people wanted or because that's what they felt was good for the country, as compared with making decisions based upon the Constitution.
Correct.
There is a rich history of the Supreme Court becoming a super legislature and doing what is best for the country rather than what the Constitution dictates. And it's the role of the Supreme Court, which we have to reserve for another show,
right,
because it's far too complex. Yeah. But it is fascinating. That is the missing piece in this conversation.
Yes, I agree, because this would probably go through several segments, but bottom line, even those powers that have been assumed by the Supreme Court and so forth, those are all outside the bounds of the Constitution, and as well as outside the bounds of even the Judiciary Acts of empowering them. Now, there are some, I think, things that Congress, because literally what the Supreme Court does and focuses on is at the controls of Congress. Congress can reel them in, but they just have never chose to. And as a matter of fact, when Marshall brought in judicial review, Jefferson could have easily gone to Congress and made the appeal and said, hey, look, there's nowhere where you've given him this latitude, but he had a lot of other things to worry about. So you're right. There's lots of things that the court is definitely culpable. And I'll even say this. They're the active or the arm of action of the intelligentsia. In other words, if they believe that there's this nobler thing that needs to be done by this perception that the intelligentsia believes, like the progressive era and so forth, then they started bringing forth rulings that promoted secularism, where the Supreme Court has literally stepped on religious freedom and religious rights within our constitutional framework, to where they've actually, and I believe that they've established a national secular church, and the Supreme Court is a part of the enforcement of that. But again, that's like literally another show. We're going to be running out of time. So the last segment, because this is segment number two, if I remember correctly. So we've got one more for this, and I kind of want to reserve that. I do want to get your feelings on Republic Review. So we got 1 minute. If you can go ahead and start grandstanding, then when you hear the music, or I'll cut you off and don't take offense.
Well, the 1 minute I'm going to use is your reference to the Federalist Papers as authority for your position. The Federalist Papers were written by profound Federalists as a, think of it as a blog posting or an op-ed piece to persuade people to ratify. I do not rely upon the Federalist Papers as a statement of what the Constitution said, but rather what the founders wanted the people to think it said so they would support the Constitution. It was an op-ed piece designed for a very particular political purpose. I don't rely upon the Federalist Papers as authority for what the Constitution actually said. Just a passing comment. I can squeeze that in the 1 minute you've allotted to me.
Yeah.
Until we go.
That's okay. That's absolutely okay. And I understand that context, that the Federalist Papers weren't actually a part of the ratification debate process. But we're at the heartbreak, so I'll take this up when we come right back, folks. So stay tuned,
and we'll be right back after this short break.
Okay, so we're back, and we still have Bob's Attic, and I'm going to be getting into Republic Review. And right before we went off the air or had this hard break, Bob basically pointed that I rely heavily on the ratification debates, or not the ratification debates, the Federalist Papers. To put it into context, the Federalist Papers were op-ed type of pieces, but they were using the press and promulgating the ideas and actually dealing with the anti-federalists as well. And to be fair, actually, the press was not very free at the time, because the press, because Pauline, I believe, Mayer, she's the one that pointed out that many articles that the anti-federalists tried to publish, some of those things didn't get published in some of the papers. They wanted a special slant given to the Federalists. Being that what it is, whenever a contract is open for debate, and it's being open for, at this point, the people in selecting their representatives, and they're putting all of this stuff out, because the Federalist Papers actually started before Virginia had actually even formed, and New York had actually even formed and selected their delegates for the ratification debate process. And so the Federalist Papers were actually starting to define what this means, what this means, what this means, and forcing dialogue on the very specifics of the Constitution. And the anti-federalists, who had already had a copy, and they were pointing out their flaws. So there was these quips going back and forth. And in all honesty, you'll find almost the exact same. It's not word for word, but you'll see Madison says the same things that he said in the Federalist Papers during the ratification debates. And as a matter of fact, Nicholas, who wasn't a part of the Federalist Papers, he's, you know, clearly amplified those things when he talked about the 1,000 acres right after Madison spoke on June 8th in 1888, or 1788, my mistake. But anyway, when it comes down to negotiating of a contract, I truly believe that when you start to define what that contract says and what this means and what this doesn't mean, then those things lend to and are legally binding. The ratification debates are legally binding, and I believe that the Federalist Papers can be used to both state, and I think the DHRC, which was the effort by the University of Wisconsin, tried to capture the sentiments of the people from all the different press clippings and all the different documents that they were able to gather. And I believe it's something like 80 volumes now of the ratification process of the Constitution. It started, I think, in 1776, and I don't think they're finished yet. But anyway, the point is that in a contract, there is this point where the negotiations are, I believe this line means this, and then when both parties accept that that's what this means, then that is a legally binding term and definition of the contract. Is that not right?
Well, you're exactly right as a lawyer, but one of the issues I have with, and I generally am in agreement with you, but one of the issues I have is with the first three words of the Constitution.
Yes.
We the people. There was considerable discussion about whether that should be we the people or we the states. And Gouverneur Morris, one of the most interesting men
yes.
of the founding era, himself, he's a fascinating study. Pegleg, a rakish man about town, a real ladies' man, very cool guy to learn about. He's one of my favorite founders. Well, Gouverneur Morris actually was the author of We the People. He was on the style committee
for right.
finishing up the Constitution, and he probably invented the phrase We the People. But you are, when you have, as you call it, a contract, and let's use your formulation, if the Constitution is a contract, it is a contract, one might say a social compact, between the people and the general, now called federal government, that it creates.
Well,
so the parties who can enforce it are the people, but not the states, because the states aren't parties to it.
Yeah, so you'd have to read my book to get, I think, some of the backstories on some of these things, why I use general government instead of federal government, and why I did not refer to we the people per se, because there's a real danger with today's useful idiots in America, because they've been inculcated in believing we live in a democracy, and they believe we the people means democracy, and that, you know, one voice, mob rule, so forth. And the intent was a Republican form of government, and it was intended to be representative. And as a matter of fact, the Constitution and its ratification, when I point this out to many John Birch Society folks and others, the Constitution wasn't voted by, you know, an up or down vote on we the people. What they did was they sent representatives and delegates to basically argue and speak for them in a Republican form. And so, as Madison, I think, articulated it best in the Virginia ratification debates, and this was also on June 8th, 1788, where he said, it's not we the people as a collective body, but it's we the people as the collective bodies of each state. And I'm paraphrasing. So it's the we the people of the state of Virginia that are ratifying and supporting this document. And it's we the people of this other state. And so when we use that term, we the people, I wanted to stay off that icy ground or that very thin ice of, is this a democracy or is this a republic? It's a constitutional republic. And so I just wanted to make sure that I didn't lend to, yes, as a democracy mob rule, we can change things. We need to work within the confines of the republic and the republican structure that we're supposed to be living, i.e. the guarantee clause, Article 4, Section 4, where all states are supposed to be republican in form as well. And we've even moved away from that. And so I see this huge danger of democracy that has gotten unleashed because of the education process. And that's the only reason why I've phrased or I marginalized the we the people, if you understand that.
I do. I understand that entirely. I was only focusing on the somewhat narrow issue
right.
of
yeah.
when you characterize the Constitution as a contract, then you have to ask yourself, a contract, okay, but between who and who? And it's something like, let's assume I belong to the Kiwanis Club. I'm a member of the Kiwanis Club. If I sign a contract in my personal capacity, I am not binding the Kiwanis Club, nor can the Kiwanis Club sue to enforce the contract. The fact that I'm also a member of the Kiwanis Club is quite irrelevant to my capacity as the contracting party. And
right.
the Constitution, to use your formulation, is a formulation of we the people as the contracting body. The fact that they're a resident of a state is kind of, if you follow my analogy, besides the point. That was my only issue.
That's fine. But in probably the 2.5 minutes we have left, what do you believe, in reading my premise on our thesis on Republic Review, do you not believe that is a viable, it's one, it's, I, it, There's no constitutional scholar that's been able to quip or even say, you can't do this, this is unconstitutional. But a lot of them don't like it because it'll tear apart their little fiefdoms. Those in the education department will lose all their funding. What are your feelings on Republic Review?
Well, of course. The federal government, with all of its economic power, has created profound and powerful pockets of self-interest who have such an economic stake in the status quo, they dread any change in the status quo.
Oh, yeah.
Because it reshuffles the deck, and all of the power they've accumulated would be lost. Now, I say, what a great thing is that?
Yes.
I love reshuffling of power. So in terms of the goals, I'm your biggest supporter, because I don't like it the way it is now. I'm profoundly unhappy with what we have become.
So
in terms of the goals, I'm your biggest supporter, whether you know it or not.
Awesome. So here's the rub for you, or here's the paradox that you may see, is that for me to move this forward, I actually have to use or work with we the people in the grassroots essence, because it's going to require constitutional warriors. So I have a second executive summary coming forth. And in all honesty, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold you over for a couple more segments so that we can just close this on Republic Review, if that's okay with you. But I have a second executive summary, and my intent is to either use a coalition with an existing very conservative state and or using constitutional principles within each county, because that's how states are divided up, and moving the Constitution from the ground level back up into the state legislatures, forcing them to do their job in ending federal tyranny. And so here we are at the end of the show. And so, Bob, if you could hold on to do one more segment with me, maybe we can get more feedback on this. And folks, we'll be back next week. Thank you very much.